From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Starting in January, NV Energy customers in Southern Nevada will see big changes to their bills. That's because the state's largest utility is moving forward with a controversial new rate structure known as daily demand pricing. The move largely does away with how customers have traditionally paid for energy. Instead, the company will now charge ratepayers based on their peak daily demand, a 15-minute snapshot of a residential customer's highest electricity usage during the day. The reason for the change, the company argues, is that it makes up for inequities between solar and non-solar customers. They say rooftop solar owners who sell power back to the grid aren't paying their fair share for new electricity infrastructure and upkeep. With the change, the company insists that a majority of its customers will see little to no increase in their bills, and if anything, they'll have more tools to help them save money. But many in the community aren't buying it. Many others are confused. So, what does the change mean for NV Energy customers and the company? We set out to find the answer in this report. It's mid-April, and it's unseasonably warm as dozens of people gather for a community meeting at the Clark County Library. The AC is blasting. The topic? Upcoming changes to power bills.
All right. Hello and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this town hall. Are you here? Are you ready to make your voices heard this evening? Are you ready to say we are tired of utilities taking advantage of us?
The Nevada Environmental Justice Coalition is hosting the meeting, along with other advocacy groups. It's focused on the impact of NV Energy's new daily demand charges. The change, approved last September by the Public Utilities Commission of Nevada, or PUCN, has sparked backlash across much of Southern Nevada. People's concern is that it will lead to higher power bills.
Penny more! Not a penny more! Not a penny! Say it!
Here's how it works. Instead of paying for how much power they use during the day, customers will now be charged 14 cents per kilowatt hour for the 15 highest usage minutes in the single day. The utility then multiplies that amount by 4 to determine a household's highest hourly impact on the grid for that day. At the same time, NV Energy has reduced its basic service charge. That's the fee customers pay to have service. It's also lowered its volumetric rate, which is how much customers pay for power. The company says that restructuring will lead to lower bills for most customers. Here's NV Energy's Vice President of Regulatory and Resource Planning, John Elisecki, explaining how it works at a meeting of the legislature's Joint Interim Standing Committee on Growth and Infrastructure earlier this year.
The design of the entire rate is revenue neutral for the company, meaning that the amount of revenue that the company is set to collect through its bills will not increase because of this charge. What's happening is that the demand charge itself reflects how the customers use energy, i.e. their highest 15-minute usage on each day. If they have a bad day and usage, if a customer runs their air conditioning and loads it up at the same time with other appliances, that only impacts that day, and the very next day, their daily demand is reset.
Many in the community aren't buying it. In June, Southern Nevadans packed the Public Utilities Commission's most recent consumer session to push back against NV Energy's upcoming daily demand charge. That includes Robert Casper, a retired union leader, and Pastor G. Rodney King of Mount Ararat Baptist Church in North Las Vegas. They were among those who showed up to voice concerns.
It's just a shell game. It's a phony shell game. You ever try to look at your electric bill and try to figure out what your charges are and what they really are?
We're already paying enough money as it is for everything else. And now they're talking about charging us the highest rate for 15 minutes for the whole day? That's unfair.
PUCN Commissioner Tammy Cordova was also at that consumer session. Before the meeting opened to public comments, she told the crowd that the move was focused on lowering costs for the majority of NV Energy customers. And the best way to do that was to end some of the benefits that residential rooftop solar customers receive.
If you're connected to the grid, all of that infrastructure is there to serve you, whether you use it a lot or a little. And so this is part of the frustration that I've had. And I know folks say, well, you just sit there, Commissioner, and you don't really listen to us. No, I have. I've heard folks talk about My bill is so much. It is so hard to be able to afford. Costs for everything are going up, which includes the cost for the poles and the infrastructure that the utility has to buy. And so case after case after case, I heard about this subsidy as a result of the way rates were designed, that people that couldn't afford solar were paying because people who could afford solar weren't paying. And so that's why I did something about it, was because folks came in here and they said, we can't afford you to keep increasing our bills. And I said, well, one thing I do have control over is I can say you don't have to pay that subsidy for the people that have solar anymore.
Cordova said the PUCN bases its decisions on evidentiary testimony and data. PUCN officials declined to comment on the record for this story, but they did note on background that the evidence shows the change will amount to lower monthly bills for most customers. Marie Steele was also at that Public Utilities Commission meeting. She's NV Energy's Vice President of Business Technology Integration. In a separate interview with KNPR, Steele reiterated that the move would balance inequities between solar and non-solar users.
It's a modernization so that we can see and more accurately reflect how the grid is being used. And it's also to normalize an inequity between solar and non-solar customers. I would say that everyone needs to pay their fair share, right? And they are being compensated for the energy that they are exporting back. So this is just a more equitable way to pay for the grid that we are all using.
Groups such as Vote Solar and Solar United Neighbors and the Toyabe chapter of the Sierra Club oppose the change, as does the state's Bureau of Consumer Protection. They filed two lawsuits challenging the rate, framing it as an illegal change that penalizes solar customers. Judges in Carson City and Clark County denied those suits from moving forward, siding with the PUCN and NV Energy. Attorney General Aaron Ford has vowed to take the case to the state Supreme Court, but it remains unclear whether the court would take up the matter. Christy Watson is the executive director of the Nevada Conservation League. She says the restructuring is aimed directly at halting the state's progress on renewable energy development.
Yeah, well, there's no question. The data supports that clean, renewable, affordable energy is the cheapest and most reliable way to go. Why we're even having conversations about expanding fossil fuel is beyond me. We have not exhausted our resources to make sure that we're investing in battery storage, geothermal, and solar energy. We're the sunniest state in the nation. Other states are meeting their renewable portfolio standard, and Nevada is not. And that is the fault of NV Energy, and the PUCN needs to hold them accountable to that. There's absolutely no reason why we should be paying for dirty, expensive fossil fuels when we could, as the sunniest state in the nation, be leading the way on clean, affordable, renewable energy.
For Mary Wagner, the move is especially upsetting because it punishes people who are trying to protect their families and the environment. Here's Wagner, the Nevada field organizer for Moms Clean Air Force.
They haven't been able to prove at all that that is going to be the case. If anything, they have proven that people that have solar panels are going to be paying more instead of paying less. And so it's unfortunate that they are punishing the people who are doing the best to ensure that we are mitigating our energy resources in our state, but also the people that are doing something for clean air. We do have high air pollution on top of extreme heat in our state, and it's unfair that people that are doing something to ensure that they're helping our state are being punished by the very company that's supposed to service us.
Despite the opposition, the new rate structure is, for all intents and purposes, the law of the land. And barring legal intervention, NV Energy's daily demand charge will go into effect January 1st, 2027. Between now and then, the company says it will educate customers about the rate change's effect on them. Here's NV Energy's Marie Steele again.
I mean, I think it's a hard concept to understand, but we're excited. You know, the education that just went out helps them see that from a month perspective, their bill probably went down or it's insignificant from like a dollar. I think what will help in what's coming out in the next month is actually seeing that annual bill compare, right? And so that's what's forthcoming in the next month is an annual bill compare and a website tools that will help you see what your usage is at every 15-minute interval, right? Is it your air conditioning? Is it your pool pump, right? They'll have a lot more information about what's going on behind the meter to help them see what's making up that bill. So I think, you know, it'll be great to get more information into their hands, and that's what's happening now.
Still, other energy experts question the need for the change.
The argument that NV Energy is trying to make in this case, and what other utilities have made over a number of years is trying to shift basically more of the cost that the utility incurs into some sort of a cost that's not controlled by the consumer.
That's Stephanie Chase, a research and communications manager at the Energy and Policy Institute. She previously worked for the Public Counsel Unit at the Washington State Attorney General's Office as a regulatory analyst advocating on behalf of consumers. Chase says there's a pretty clear reason why NV Energy would go in this direction.
Typically in a residential bill, there's a fixed charge amount, which is supposed to pay for the cost of, you know, wires and poles and connecting your home or your apartment to service. And then there's a variable charge that's your usage charge. That's what you're paying like per kilowatt hour. Utilities have a lot of incentive to try to shift more of those costs to being into the fixed charge versus into the variable charge, because consumers can upgrade the efficiency of their home. They can do weatherization and those sort of things to bring down their usage. But if the utility puts more into sort of these fixed charges or the, you know, more standard charges or a demand charge, then that is less controllable by the consumer. And the utility is going to be able to, you know, collect a bigger proportion of their bill through those ways that the customer cannot control every month.
As of now, NV Energy's daily demand pricing is only slated to go into effect for Southern Nevada customers. Company officials have said on the record, though, that they plan to impose the rate structure on Northern Nevada customers in the future. And as a note, Nevada Public Radio receives financial support from NV Energy. If you've driven through rural Nevada, you know that there are long stretches of lonely highway where the nearest gas station might be 100 miles away. And for those driving electric vehicles, the experience driving between charging stations can be harrowing. The Mount West News Bureau's Caleb Bradle tagged along for a summer road trip across Nevada in an EV. Here's that experience.
Hey, Scott.
Hey. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. How you doing?
Very good.
How's the trip going?
Trip's going amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
when beautiful. I meet Scott Allison, he's halfway through a 6-day road trip around Nevada. He and his husband left their hometown of Las Vegas a few days earlier. Now they're making a stop in Reno before heading east towards some of the state's most remote highways. I ask him what it's like being an EV driver in the state.
That depends on how much Nevada you want to see.
We climb into his electric SUV and head toward Virginia City. From Las Vegas, Allison drove through California and up Highway 395, where chargers are plentiful. It wasn't the fastest route. That would have been taking Nevada's Highway 95. But the charging is sparse, Allison says.
There are a few chargers on that route, but it's not, you know, there's like single point of failure. So if one is down, your trip is going to be messed up.
For Allison and the 77,000 registered EV owners in Nevada, those workarounds are part of traveling. And for state lawmakers, they're exactly what the system is trying to eliminate. But after the state lost more than $12 million in federal charging funds this year, expanding the network faces another hurdle. Nevada lawmaker Howard Watts says drivers face those gaps every time they leave major highways.
There is just really limited charging infrastructure. You know, some of the stations are not operational or fully reliable, and there is just not enough charging to allow people to easily move across the state.
Watts says that challenge is especially sharp in rural Nevada, where distances between towns can stretch past 100 miles. He adds that the lack of charging infrastructure doesn't just affect Nevada's EV drivers.
People are coming into Nevada from other states and want to get around in their electric vehicles. And if they have difficulty doing so, then that impacts our economies, whether it's in Las Vegas, Reno, or especially in our rural communities.
Industry groups working on electrified transportation say that experience of planning, rerouting, and uncertainty needs to change if EV adoption is going to scale. Lizzie Steers with Advanced Energy United says one of the biggest misconceptions is that EVs simply don't work outside cities.
EVs are absolutely up to the challenge and do the work. And so people might be surprised how plentiful the EV charging infrastructure already is around them, or how easy that would be to be in their life.
She says affordability is also central to adoption, especially when drivers look at the full cost of ownership.
If you look at all the elements that go into owning a vehicle, from that purchase cost, the fueling or charging costs, the maintenance costs, almost always now EVs will come out ahead and will have higher savings.
Back on the road, Scott says those trade-offs are part of learning how to travel differently in Nevada. Not every route is simple, but with enough planning, most of them are possible.
There's two types of EV drivers. The people who are in the know and do lots of planning and research like I do. And then there's probably a lot more who just jump in the car and go, and then don't realize until it's perhaps too late that they're going to get stranded.
And that tension between what works on paper and what works on the road is exactly what Nevada's EV future is still trying to resolve. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Cup final is only 4 days away, and U.S. enthusiasm for soccer is at a high point. For most of July, fans have been traveling across North America wearing jerseys from the 48 participating countries and cheering really anywhere the games are being broadcast. That's from Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City during the quarterfinal match between Argentina and Switzerland, courtesy of Kansas City World Cup 2026. So how's this excitement being felt in Las Vegas? Has it trickled down to Nevada's only professional soccer team, the Las Vegas Lights? And will it continue beyond the World Cup? Earlier this week, we put those questions to Lights CEO Sean McIntosh and UNLV Professor of Sports Management Nancy Lowe. Here's that conversation. Sean, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the World Cup. What kind of excitement have you noticed at Cashman Field?
Yeah, look, the World Cup is a tremendous opportunity to bring new eyeballs onto this sport. We've certainly seen an increase in local buzz and conversation around the sport. You take a look at all the watch parties being hosted across Las Vegas, some tremendous scenes, celebrations. And for us, we've seen that trickle effect. Now, we've only played one match here at home during the World Cup. It was our July 4th game, and it was our largest attendance here in venue of the season. So hard to completely make that correlation, because July 4th always does really well for us. But certainly there's some anecdotal evidence to suggest like the increase in people tuning into the sport through the World Cup has had a positive effect.
You all have hosted watch parties and theme nights to build on this excitement. Through those events, are you seeing more first-time fans, maybe stronger engagement from current fans?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for us, that's an easy measurement. When we're taking RSVPs for these watch parties, kind of cross-referencing our database and some of these names that we're taking in, definitely some new eyes and some new fans that haven't yet been in our database, which is a positive.
You know, interest has ebbed and flowed around previous World Cup tournaments. The challenge is always turning new or casual viewers into longtime soccer fans. How do you keep people engaged past that final match?
That's really something that every club is thinking about coming off of a World Cup. And it's challenging because you have this wave of new fans that are consuming this sport for the first time or for the first time in 4 years. You know, a lot of the conversations are about everything besides the football on the field. You're seeing that conversation, but you're seeing people falling in love with the Erling Haaland, who has become such a big deal because of his personality on social. You're seeing the streets littered with diverse cultures, and we can bring that. And so we're really encouraging people to support your local football club, whether that's a USL or MLS team or MLS Next Pro, because that's how we grow the U.S. men's national team, is by strengthening our local club so that, you know, hopefully in the next 4 years, we're talking about the U.S. team making a run to the semifinals and quarterfinals. But I think it's really important. If you're falling in love with what you're seeing, find a way to support local.
That was Sean McIntosh, CEO of Las Vegas Lights Football Club, the city's USL Championship soccer team. I want to bring in Nancy Lowe. She's a UNLV professor of sports management. Nancy, appreciate you joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
Soccer is the most popular sport in the world. Of course, that doesn't ring true here in the U.S. It's usually trailing behind American football, basketball, baseball, sometimes hockey. Why is there that disconnect? If it's so popular so everywhere else, why don't Americans love it as much?
Well, that's a question that we can certainly point to a number of different factors. One of the biggest is just simple market saturation. We are, without question, given many, many opportunities to watch a lot of different sports. You mentioned the Big Four. They get the biggest amount of media historically, but even in the context of the World Cup happening, you know, there's still competitive professional basketball happening. There's still Wimbledon happening. There's still many, many sports that are happening. And so the splintering of attention is one factor. The market saturation of the major mainstream sports here in the U.S. is another factor. And Americans in general don't really like the slow pace of soccer. So we like to see high scoring. We like to see the prevalence of a winner. So the other aspect of soccer that's unique that sometimes makes American fans crazy is this idea that it can end in a tie. So there's a few things that are culturally relevant to the sport of soccer that distinguishes it in a way that doesn't always align with Americans' generalized preference.
From a psychological perspective, how much is the enthusiasm behind these global sports events like the World Cup, the Olympics, more largely rooted in maybe national pride than the actual sport itself?
Well, yes, national pride is a very, very significant factor. And it's, you know, that's the one that's easy for fans to jump on and be a flag waving, you know, symbol carrying fan that shows their alignment with the country that they espouse to support. The interesting thing is that that type of fandom doesn't tend to translate to the local club level very well historically. And there's a host of reasons for that. You think about who is on your national team as one of your top athletes. And if it's entirely possible within the context of global soccer, that one of those players, one of those athletes is on your national team, but is a competitor or a rival of sorts in the leagues that you follow religiously. So it can make for some really difficult tensions as far as a true fan is considered. But a casual fan, you know, we get a lot of casual fans that line up for the Olympic Games, for the FIFA World Cups. And when all the excitement is over, they go back most of the time to being a very casual fan. You know, they might watch the national team play. You know, there's no small significance in that. National team fans will often follow the national team around, but it doesn't mean that it's going to translate easily to a local team.
You know, when I think of professional sports, I sometimes maybe think about the pipeline for professional sports, whether that's starting off with peewee football and then going to high school football, college, and the pros, or whether that's playing t-ball when you're a kid and then making it all the way through those leagues. There seems to be lots of kids playing soccer every weekend on every field I see around town. It seems like there is quite a bit of a growing base of future players. Why aren't we seeing more of those kids make it to these international teams?
Well, so it's interesting because on the one hand, the question prior to this was all about fans, and now we're talking about participation, right? And that's one of the places where, you know, to large measure, the folks in the marketing, the ticket sales, the revenue generation side of sport in the U.S. isn't always very well aligned with the participation aspect and the development of the connection between understanding the game, participating in the game, coaching the game, and actually being a fan of the game. So it might seem somewhat ironic, but In this country, we have a very elitist soccer community in the sense that if your child is playing soccer, the average American family is going to spend anywhere from $900 to $1,200 a year for their kids' expenses, but that's on the low end of youth soccer. If they get into the club levels and they start playing at the elite levels, they're traveling across the country. The amount of money that these parents are spending is in the thousands of dollars. And quite honestly, that investment is something that's unique to the U.S. in many ways and could in some ways erode the discretionary income you have for, say, buying tickets to the lights, right? We have to think about the role of professional sport teams in the building of the soccer fan base that's more organic in the sense that I grew up playing soccer. I love the game. I know how to cheer for it. I know what I'm watching for. Therefore, I couldn't possibly miss a lights match, right? There's a little bit of a gap there that isn't well tended to by all teams. And I'm not calling anyone out, but I will tell you one of the greatest successes of VGK is the way that they built hockey as a participation sport in Southern Nevada. It's phenomenal. And that certainly is driving their fan base. There's a connection there.
Sean, I want to fold you back in here. What do you think?
It comes down to culture. You know, let's kind of compare this to a sport Americans are familiar with, American football, right? You think about the states that are the best at developing talent. It's in their culture, right? Why is the South, why are Texas and Florida so dominant when it comes to producing high level talent in comparison to a New York? It's because it's such a part of the fabric of their community, their culture. And so we're unique in that, you know, and Nancy touched on this at the beginning, we're unique in that we've got a divided attention. And so you've got football, basketball, you think about the success of VGK and it's because it's become now a fabric of the culture here. The participation followed the excitement behind VGK. I don't know that it happens in the reverse order.
Professor, interest in youth soccer rose significantly in the mid-90s. That coincided with the United States hosting the 1994 World Cup. Interest hasn't grown at the same rate since then. Do you expect to see a big spike in youth interest after this year's World Cup has ended?
So I would just submit to you that 1994 was not the last time we had World Cup in the U.S. The fact of the matter is the numbers that this particular World Cup have been trying to rise to, and I believe they've surpassed them, but were set in 1999 and then were set by the U.S. Women's National Team. So, you know, simply referring only to the Men's World Cup is one of those issues that we continually have with regard to not acknowledging that when it comes to soccer, the most successful team in this country is the U.S. Women's National Team. And interestingly, to go back to Sean's point about culture, without question, culture is a huge part. The interesting thing is that the culture of soccer in this country is extremely strong when it comes to girls and women. And that's what I was referring to when I said that fans follow the U.S. National Team. I actually meant the U.S. Women's National Team to play friendlies, you know, wherever they're playing them. So unfortunately, we tend to forget that there is phenomenal success for soccer in this country that is evidenced by the NWSL, that is evidenced by the U.S. Women's National Team, and is evidenced by the number of girls that are participating in soccer. So when we think about the bigger picture, if we think about soccer as a global game, the interesting thing is that the U.S. leads with regard to women. And that's because many of the teams in other countries have suppressed, if not completely made it impossible for women to participate in soccer for many, many years. Now that that's changing, we're seeing an incredible shift in the landscape globally. So I think one of the things that I would always encourage when we talk about global sports and we talk about participation in sport is that we don't just arbitrarily align it specifically just with boys and men, because we are at a time in this world, not just in this country, where 50% of your fans of women's sport are men, but guess what? 45% of your fans of men's sport are women. So, you know, if you want to talk about how do we get the interest in the World Cup to transfer to the local level, think about how you're appealing to girls and women and not just guys. because there's a whole market of people out there that know soccer, love soccer, get the culture, and want to be a part of it that oftentimes are not given much attention.
I think that's where we're going to have to leave it. Nancy Lowe is a UNLV professor of sports management. Sean McIntosh, CEO of the Las Vegas Lights Football Club. Nancy, Sean, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Before Celine Dion and Elton John ushered in the era of the big concert residencies, production shows ruled the strip. It seemed every property in the tourist corridor had one, two, three, or even more, featuring everything from dancers and illusionists to acrobats and ventriloquists. 20 years ago, the strip even boasted four permanent Broadway shows. As recently as 2013, Cirque du Soleil had seven shows going on at the same time. Events affecting the economy have wiped out many productions. But it's not the only reason why ticket buyers have been prioritizing other forms of live entertainment. Here with insight on what's going on is John Katsalamidis, entertainment columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He sat down with KNPR's Mike Privat earlier this week. And as a note, several of the companies and venues mentioned in this conversation are corporate supporters of Nevada Public Radio.
John, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, sir.
So, John, plenty of production shows are still being staged in Las Vegas, but fewer of them, certainly fewer large-scale shows than, you know, I would say maybe 20 years ago. Why is that?
There are myriad issues about this topic. I will tell you that off the top, what Las Vegas has become is it's a very top-heavy city when it comes to sports and entertainment, hospitality, culinary, retail. When you add all that up, it's taken a big chunk out of the tourist time in Las Vegas and even those who live here. And I start with Sphere. First and foremost, takes, you know, about 100,000 tickets out of the market every weekend. Allegiant Stadium, T-Mobile Arena, Golden Knights, Raiders. After that, multiple theater residency headliners that take a lot of tickets out of the market and take a lot of tourist revenue out of the market as well. So that has a down ballot effect on the smaller shows.
I wonder also if these shows tend to also be more expensive to produce.
Well, I think the revenue and the business model for some of these shows has become lower overhead. I think producers are not able to spend as much money on shows that they're bringing into hotel casinos. Keep in mind, we're in a four-wall environment these days where a producer or an entertainer, an act themselves will rent the room. And then it's on them to sell tickets. And if you're only selling X amount of tickets and you can't afford to make the show as lavish as you might want to, then you're going to have a downward spiral in quality. And if you don't have great quality, you're not going to get a big crowd. And if you don't get a big crowd, you're not going to have great quality. And down the chute we go.
Yeah, right. I wonder if you also have any sense that the traditional Las Vegas show spectacular has maybe also fallen out of favor with the public on some level.
We talked about this a lot about a decade ago, a little bit more than a decade ago, when Jubilee closed. And that was the last of the big feather shows. It was an only in Vegas. You can only see it spectacular, but it lost its audience long before it closed. And at that point, we understood that the era of that scale of Las Vegas production had probably ended in that way. We're seeing a lot of smaller shows, a lot of experiential shows, you know, to use that term, a lot of you go in and experience something as part of the entertainment rather than sitting there and watching something grand. So even companies that have made that their business model and artistic image in Las Vegas, like Cirque du Soleil, don't make those shows anymore. You know, the last time Cirque brought a show in was Matt Applin replacing Zumanity, which is about half the scale of Zumanity. And that's about what you're going to see. So the short answer is yes. The only asterisk, the exception to that, is Awakening at Wynn. They own that show. It's as big as anything that's ever been produced in the recent history in Las Vegas. But I think that's the last of its kind.
I was going to ask you about that. We might as well talk about it now. $120 million show. It's nearing its fourth year.
Yep.
And it seemed for a while that, you know, anecdotally speaking, it seemed like that felt like the bellwether of whether a Las Vegas production show might continue on in its evolution. What's your sense of how it's doing?
Well, it's still open. I will tell you that. Now, I can't speak to this. I don't know if Awakening would be sustaining itself if it were an outside production. I really believe that the hotel is supporting that thing as an amenity for the people who visit the hotel in a lot of ways. If it were selling out every show all the time, we'd see more examples of this. We'd probably see a Cirque du Soleil show coming in or in development that would be like Awakening, you know, that in that way. As we know in Las Vegas, being derivative of everything, a chance, an opportunity to replicate it.
Shirley, you had mentioned something about this being a top-down city. I wanted to bring up a quote from Jonathan Jossel. He's the CEO of Downtown's Plaza Hotel and Casino, which, by the way, they just debuted a dance-oriented production show called Bolero in its showroom, as you have reported. Last September, Jossel told WBUR this, and I'm quoting here, "Las Vegas maybe's forgotten some of the messaging, which is to say, it's not just an event town, and people can still come here and have a great time at a great price point and enjoy a weekend without going to see a crazy concert or without having to spend a fortune." Do you think that all this focus on the event, the big shows, have especially been hard hitting on the smaller properties, off-strip properties, downtown properties?
I know what Jonathan is saying there. Las Vegas's identity is in large part as an entertainment and tourism destination because of big events. When I moved here in the 90s, we had boxing events were the big thing here, right? And of course, we had New Year's Eve going on Fremont Street included. It's known for big events, and we have more big events more frequently all year round that aren't necessarily pegged to anything. You come here any weekend and there's some sort of thing happening. I think that what has happened is that people treat Las Vegas as an event-driven destination, and they just focus on the event. I think that's what Jonathan's getting at. They don't think of the second and third thing they're going to do.
John, I'm going to ask you to put your history hat on. By our count, there's probably been about 13 or so fairly major production shows that have closed between January 2023 and January 2026. Now, two of them closed because their parent properties did. We're talking Beatles Love at Mirage and Murray the Magician at the Tropicana. Had there been a previous period of time where it felt like so many production shows were shuttering all at once?
About a decade ago, we had double that.
Really? 16.
That is a lot, and that's probably an example of what I used to wince at this term, but I'm beginning to really believe in it, market saturation. You know, we still sell more tickets than anybody in the world in terms of live entertainment, but you mentioned, you know, when there's a shift in a property closing or a shift in maybe a resort wanting to, take over the Mirage Hard Rock, which will have a lot of live entertainment when it comes online, believe it. And I think that that is a big reason why we have less overall smaller shows. We still sell more than ever in this city. It's just the nature of what is available has gone sort of up the ladder.
You had mentioned the fact that Vegas seems to be selling more tickets than ever in the live entertainment realm. Vegas in 2025 saw 7.5% fewer visitors than 2024.
Mm-hmm.
2026, apparently we are already on the uptick. I'm wondering if you have noticed a correlation between visitation and show ticket sales, the pandemic notwithstanding.
From producers I have, and that's exactly the timeline I'm looking at. In February of 25, when we started having, you know, tariff policy enacted, more than one producer said, watch out for Canada. Watch out for our international visitors. You don't want to mess around with that. And it was something that we hadn't talked about a lot because Canada, we'll just use them as an example, was so consistently here. That database was built back in the Celine Dion days. It's been there for a long time through Shania Twain. They come to the rodeo. They love Las Vegas. It's one of our biggest international, if not the biggest slice of the international tourism market pie. When that happened, I started hearing. We had one producer, Sir Harry Cowell, who had the Raiding the Rock Vault show at the Hard Rock Cafe, small show, resident production, was just getting by, you know, just, you know, when that happened, they have a lot of Canadian rockers in this show. When that happened, he specifically said, we have lost so much Canadian interest that we have to take the show down and try to tour it.
You know, it's easy to overlook when we're talking about these big shows like Cirque du Soleil, Absinthe, Spiegel World. It's easy to overlook how much magic is available here in Las Vegas. We have two big shows still. We have Penn & Teller. We have Chris Angel's Mind Freak. Those are 1,500 or so seated shows. But then there's a ton of smaller shows that kind of is flecked throughout the tourist corridor. Is magic in Las Vegas relatively bulletproof?
You know, I have to tell you, I think it is. I did a count not long ago of named headliners in the magic space, hypnotists, mentalists, whatever you want to call them, just the headliners, 25.
Oh.
And yeah, really. And I was shocked, but that is true. Hmm. We're going to have a production show, a magic production show called Now You See Me, come into the Copperfield Theater. They're not done with magic there yet.
Also, within this big realm of production shows, I think it's also maybe easy to overlook the, I'll just call them the sexy shows, with the half-naked women and men performing. You have Ex-Burlesque, Fantasy, Magic
mm-hmm.
Mike.
Mm-hmm.
I think Chippendales is on its third venue now.
Yes.
Still hanging in there.
Thunder over at Excalibur. Thunder from Down Under just celebrated 25 years in Las Vegas, too. Yes. Yeah.
So longevity makes me feel like, much like magic shows, maybe these are just part of the fabric of the Vegas entertainment scene and also maybe kind of bulletproof too.
Yeah, I wrote years ago that the dirty little secret in Las Vegas male reviews, and this was some time ago, about Chippendales and Thunder. This is about when Magic Mike was opening over at the old Hard Rock. Those shows do well, and they have longevity. They're doing different types of business now, and they're different types of shows, but they're still running. Magic Mike, the newcomer, is 10 years on now. The topless reviews, beginning with Fantasy and Ex-Burlesque, still do great business. Again, only in Vegas. There seems to be them benefiting from that reputation, too.
I get the feeling also that they're also on the cheaper end of your options if you're looking for, as you were saying, the second and third thing that you might do in town. I'm also thinking of these review-style shows. You mentioned the V Theater earlier. V, the ultimate variety show I've heard for years,
mm-hmm.
is a best-kept secret in this town.
It really is good. And so is Vegas' show and Sax Theater. Same thing.
I've heard mm-hmm. the same thing. And they also seem like they are a lot more accessible than, say, these upper tier production shows that we've been mentioning. Is that essential to the survival of the production show, especially as we keep hearing things are just a lot more expensive in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I think I think if we're going to be, and I say this a lot, if we're going to be considered the entertainment capital of the world, we have to do more than just Sphere and big touring shows and Bruno Mars and all the usual suspects. There has to be some mid-level value entertainment that is good. The shows that you mentioned, I always say, one of my favorite underrated shows is Zombie Burlesque, man. They just cut their schedule by a couple nights a week, because their numbers weren't right. There's just a lot of talent that you wouldn't expect out there that you have to lead people to.
I want to talk about another completely different type of production show. Maybe it's an obvious one, but it's not well represented right now on the Strip, and that is the Broadway musical.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely an up-and-down history in this city as far as the Strip is concerned. We had some long-term residencies like The Lion King, Mamma Mia, Jersey
Yep.
Boys, the Vegas reworking of Phantom. A lot have ended prematurely, though. The Venetian is experimenting with a couple of limited engagements this year with Mrs. Doubtfire. That starts next week.
Yep.
The Book of Mormon for November. But, do you have any idea why otherwise the Strip has been cold on those lately?
Well, we had this thing go on a long time ago called Broadway West in Las Vegas, and those shows you just mentioned were at the loggerhead of that whole thing, that whole period of time. And we thought that Las Vegas, because of its, tourism numbers and its infrastructural, invention, was going to be that type of city. It didn't succeed for a lot of reasons. I just felt, even at the time, that people didn't come to Las Vegas to see Broadway. I don't think enough of them did. We had great shows. I mean, Mamma Mia, the original Mamma Mia at Mandalay Bay was great, really well done. Chicago was as good as what it was on tour and on Broadway as well. Big stars in those shows, Chita Rivera, Mary Lou Henner, Hal Linton. I mean, it's like, it was a real show. And I think what happened in Las Vegas is there was this feeling that we should have that culture represented, and it was taken, that audience was taken by the Smith Center for the Performing Arts. When it opened, everybody said, okay, there wasn't that appetite, but we just know, even if we don't know specifically what's coming in, We know that it's going to be there. You know, Doubtfire and Book of Mormon have played there, right. All the biggies. I'm interested to see the original, you know, Venetian Theater, which is the Phantom Theater, is going to be the home to those shows at the Venetian now. And they haven't done too much of that. They've had the occasional, they had a Chicago version come in for a weekend several years ago. They had Priscilla, Queen of the Desert played.
Saw that too.
Yeah. I thought that was great. It got cut short.
I agree.
But that was a wonderful show. I thought at the time that was going on, that might be the way to go. We might be seeing that now, the occasional. I mean, there have been ideas for this to happen. I remember talking to George Maloof a long time ago about the Pearl Concert Theater, and we're talking about programming in there, and we're looking around it, and it was open by then. They were doing shows. And I said, what else are you doing here, you know? And he goes, you know, you could do a Broadway show in here pretty easily. And I said, yeah, you could.
You have reported that there are as many as 3 hologram-style, avatar-based shows that are slated to land in Las Vegas. They would feature ABBA, that's mm-hmm. the one you probably reported on the most, Kiss, and Elton John.
Yeah.
And if the ABBA show that's already playing in England is any indication, it's, you know, these are very concert-oriented shows, but there is clearly a lot of production to make them work, given the special effects involved. So this all said, I wonder if shows like this, do they hint that the evolution of technology is really the big factor in how Vegas entertainment itself evolves?
Yeah, I think we have to look at this in a serious way. All those shows you mentioned have been in talks with Las Vegas resorts. If you have this technology that can replicate an experience like that and give somebody a produced experience and have control over the whole event. As someone once told me, a holographic frontman, you don't lose track of him in the hotel room. You don't find the holographic frontman at the bar when he's supposed to be on stage. That is very appealing. And so is the amount of money that can be made if you get this right.
John Katzlamitis is the entertainment columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. John, thank you again for your time.
Thank you, sir.